From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. By the final episode of 24 tonight, Jack Bauer, a hero with a very dark side, has gotten just about as dark as he can get. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about wrapping up the show with executive producer Howard Gordon, and we'll discuss how events in the real world affected the show's direction. Also, audiences said goodbye to another popular TV series last night. Lost ended its six-year run. We'll take a look at that show's finale. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us about some major pieces of music never commercially recorded by composer-conductor Pierre Boulez, which have just been released on the occasion of his 85th birthday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. For fans of the Fox TV series 24, waiting these final hours for the show's last episode has been a form of what its hero, Jack Bauer, has been famous for both enduring and inflicting. Torture.
You people are so stupid. Renee Walker was no threat to you. Her work was finished. She was done. We were out. All you had to do was leave us alone. Why couldn't you just leave us alone?
That's Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Bauer, the counter-terrorist agent whose very long, very bad days are the heart of the action series 24, which ends its 9-year run tonight on Fox. Today on Fresh Air, we get ready for the 24 finale and examine the show's impact and message by talking with executive producer Howard Gordon. 24 was created by Robert Cochran and Joel Surnow. Howard Gordon, who previously had written and produced for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and the X-Files, is one of the primary shapers of the show's content and direction, as is series star Kiefer Sutherland. I spoke with Howard Gordon last week. Howard Gordon, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Dave.
I'd like to start with last week's episode, and it featured a terrific, very tense scene in which Jack Bauer, played by Kiefer Sutherland, tracks down and abducts former President Charles Logan, played by Gregory Itzen. Bauer wants information, as usual, and he's thrown the former president up against a chain-link fence kind of wall thing, occasionally punching him to get it from him. So here's the clip.
You're going to tell me everything I want to know.
Jack, you're making a mistake.
Don't you even try and pretend you're not a part of this. I found the man who killed Renee Walker, the Russian operative Pavel Takharov. I got his cell phone. The last call he got was from you.
I know, it looks like let me explain.
Explain what? That you sent him to kill me? You sent him to kill me, right?
Yes, damn it, yes.
Why'd you take out a hit on Renee Walker?
I had nothing to do with that. I was brought in after that happened.
Who brought you in?
President Taylor didn't my help to bring the Russians back to the table. I called my sources in Moscow. They told me that people in their government were behind Hassan's assassination. I told the Russian delegation I had evidence of that fact in the names of everybody. And what was just to keep at the conference? What evidence? It doesn't exist. I was playing poker. It was a bluff. It worked. It kept Taylor's peace agreement on the table. But you were determined to screw things up. I admit I was part of the cover-up, but I'm not part of the Russian conspiracy. I had nothing to do with the terrorist attack or your friend's death. I'm not the bad guy here.
That's Gregory Itzen and Kiefer Sutherland from last week's episode. I love how good a performance Gregory gives in that. I mean, there's so much exposition he's got to get through, but he keeps ratcheting up the emotional stuff.
Exposition is really that is the exact right word, and he kept it interesting and kept it, more importantly, comprehensible, obviously in the midst of that very exigent moment.
The reason why I wanted to start with this clip is not only it's really two of the really wonderful performers from the series just going toe-to-toe, literally, but the final point that he makes, you know, I'm not the bad guy here, this season has had even more than usual, a lot of good guy, bad guy flip-flops, including Jack Bauer. And I wanted to start by asking you about that, if that was an intentional part of the final season.
Very much so. Probably more so than any other season, we had an idea for this season. And often in years past, we have aspired to have, get a good beginning and understand where we're starting and just as an act of faith, hope that we'd find our way to the end. And this year we had a governing idea from the very beginning, and that was that Jack would start from a place of a possible happy second chance. For the first time in a long time, Jack was actually happy. He'd forgiven himself for the things that he'd done, and imperfectly, of course, and he, I think, honoring the complexity and the darkness of his past deeds, he still had started from a place where, okay, maybe I'll rejoin the human race. And we added to that a very important relationship in Renee Walker, played by Annie Wershing. And we knew right away at the very beginning of the year that they would sort of complete the relationship that they began last year, that complex relationship that was really more apprentice-mentor than anything else, but that was always charged with something else, and consummated this year. And after Jack finally had that chance, take it away in true 24 fashion and ignite what you're now seeing as the last batch of episodes, and taking Jack to a place that's about as dark as we've ever seen him. And he's been in some pretty dark places.
When you say consummated, it's actually literal. It's the only love scene, I think, that Jack Bauer had in the entire series.
That's absolutely true. We had a post-coital moment between he and Audrey in season 4 when we introduced her, but that was just putting on the tie after some period of time. But yes, this was the first time. It was something we have been looking to do in the most generic way because it seemed like an interesting real-time thing to be doing. And of course, that's a whole nother story in terms of how long does it take Jack to do it, anyway.
Well, how long did it take you? I mean, there are a dozen executive producers, it seems, on this series.
Yes.
Including Kiefer Sutherland. So when you're talking about what's going to happen to that character the next year, there's a big vote in the room in the executive producers. I'm wondering how you make the important decisions with such a sizable democracy, and when and why you decided this would be the final year for 24.
Well, to answer the first question, there are a lot of people who have the executive producer title, but mine is really the only one that counts. frankly, it's when I say counts, I shouldn't say that. It's a fairly democratic procedure. But I'd say that the democracy is they have 49% of the vote and I get 51. So,
okay.
Generally, when there were real decisions to be made, by and large, those decisions were consensus ones. I'm happy to report, but occasionally, of course, there is a deadlock, and you have to keep Monday from bumping into Tuesday, and then I got to cast that vote. That said, Kiefer really is the other one who had veto power, I should say. And his was the last hurdle or the last opinion, and really arguably the one I was most interested in. I mean, including my colleagues, including the network and the studio, Kiefer really was a partner for me, particularly in these very big moments and in the character's evolution. And it was really because he was not a titular executive producer. He was a very, very active producer, and he's a really smart guy. And he understands this character in a way that sometimes even I didn't.
24 writer and executive producer Howard Gordon in a conversation recorded last week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Howard Gordon, writer and executive producer of the Fox series 24, which ends its 9-year run tonight. The thing about this season, as it's getting to the end, is that Jack, because he's so traumatized by what happened to Renee, the FBI agent with whom he had recently fallen in love, that he's on this revenge quest that's really dark. I mean, even by 24 standards, what he's doing and what's being shown on television is pretty surprising. Here's the way President Logan's assistant, speaking by phone to his boss, describes Jack Bauer's recent behavior. Reed Diamond plays the assistant, Jason Piller, and Gregory Itzen, once again, plays the former President Logan.
The story's going to come out.
No, not necessarily. We still might be able to manage this.
Look, sir, I know you've told me that you're committed to seeing this through, but you could still extricate yourself from this mess. There's no evidence of your involvement yet. You could still delay the press announcement.
It's too late for that, Jason. The White House press secretary just announced my role in the peace process. There is no turning back.
And there's something else you should know. Bauer didn't just kill Pavel. He butchered him.
He beat him savagely, and then he eviscerated him.
I don't think Bauer's just looking to expose the Russians' involvement in the plot against his son. This guy's out for blood.
Then you better find him and stop him, hadn't you?
Yes, sir.
That's Reed Diamond and Gregory Itzen in a scene from last week's 24. I think about The Sopranos, you know, that first season episode where Tony was on a college visitation field trip mm-hmm. with his daughter and found a stool pigeon and killed him. And as viewers, we were all meant to go, whoa, you know, I'm rooting for this guy.
Right.
And I'm wondering if that's the intent with these final hours of 24, that we've rooted for Jack this entire time, but is he going too far? I mean, or are we supposed to ask that question?
It's a great question. This was a source of tremendous debate on the staff. It was interesting because there was no clear consensus as we went down this particular path. There's obviously a lot of complex feelings about it. On one hand, is Jack justified? But of course, the way he's prosecuting this is clearly brutal and violent and in the red zone of some, you know, moral gauge. And I think it's important to look at, I'll tell you anyway, the way we justified or what we meant to do. Mm-hmm. I think we meant to be confused and conflicted about this character, who, by the way, has been a hero who, you know, has generated some controversy and who, as the years have gone on, has gotten progressively darker and progressively more complex in terms of his, you know, morality and architecture. And I think here his moral compass is, there's a question. There is a question. And that really is the, and you have to look at this other, at what really has brought him to this moment. It's not merely Renee's murder. It's the fact that this other pillar of justice, Alison Taylor, the president, who even
played
had
by
her own
Cherry
daughter,
Jones, whose
played
performance
by the wonderful,
is, yeah, wow.
Magnificent. I mean, we are so blessed with these phenomenal actors, and that really is one of the great treats to see Greg Itzen and Cherry Jones and Kiefer Sutherland play together. But in this case, Cherry Jones, Alison Taylor, for reasons that I think we have earned, has come to this moment, this peace agreement, which she believes is a greater good and for which she is able to suppress justice. And the collateral damage of that justice happens to be Jack's beloved. And it's really the deprivation of that chance. I think we all believe had Jack been given proper recourse, had President Taylor in that moment come to what was the right choice, come clean, let the public, let the world know what's happened, and this peace will happen in its time. When this beacon, this pillar of law and order and of the rule of law betrays Jack, all bets are off.
Now, these questions bring to mind years and years now. 24 has been at the center of a media debate on torture, and even more so as the government struggled to define it, and it became a political issue and an election issue. And for a while, there were some people that were saying that 24 was actually more conservative rather than more liberal. And you've got all of these things going on throughout the series. If you're having these debates among your own staffers and your own producers and writers about how to go and how far to go, what does that say about how the show itself has struggled to deal with this question over the years?
Well, I will say, for one thing, we have struggled. To say that we haven't, or that we have been some de facto or mouthpiece for some political point of view, it's not only specious. I promise you, it is insane. And any fly on the wall or anyone who's been there would tell you the same. So, I mean, look, the show is a show, for one thing. It is it's a thriller in the vein of, you know, The Bourne Identity or Rambo or Dirty Harry, and you know, the hero finds the bad guy and shakes out of him where the bomb is. And again, the real time scenario lent itself in particular to that. And frankly, through the first 5 years, I don't think you could find a single article or op-ed piece that used the word torture or that even described that this was somehow morally repugnant or corrosive or anything. I think what happened was Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo happened. I think the show certainly benefited from some kind of post 9/11 wish fulfillment. You had a guy who cut to the chase, who did whatever was necessary, and there was some, you know, again, wish fulfillment involved. I do think that the show experienced some of the blowback. Obviously, we were being watched and listened to, and I don't think you can stick your head in the sand and say, we're just a TV show, get over it. We did understand that the climate had changed, that the issue, because of Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib, changed. The world had changed since the show first began, and it put us in a conundrum, honestly. At the end of season six, where Jack had been acting a certain way, we had a choice where either we renounce the series as having, we admit we're a bunch of torture-mongering, morally corrosive, torture pornographers, or we find a way of confronting this issue and this changed world that we're in. And in a strange way, it gave us fodder for the seventh season, where Jack actually is on trial for many of the same things that the show itself seemed to stand trial for. And we created the character of Alison Taylor specifically as a pole star, as someone who was a thoughtful, credible, strong, and unwavering, had a strong point of view about this very thing, torture. And under no circumstances did she ever allow it, up to and including allowing it as a way of preempting what turned out to be an attack on the White House itself.
Did you go to get any advice from interrogation experts early on?
We didn't seek any advice, but advice was offered to us after the torture issue became an issue. In subsequent seasons, we did sit down with a number of people who were, I can't remember their names, but one of them was the person whose investigation and interrogation led to the arrests of Saddam Hussein. We did talk to some interrogators, again, in the aftermath of the controversy. We sat down with some real interrogators from the military, and they gave us scenarios which were, effective interrogation techniques. The problem with them, as dramatically interesting as they were, is that they occurred in real life over the course of days and weeks, and they were trust building and psychological, things. Mm-hmm. And that's where, once again, we were hamstrung by the notion of real time. Jack has to get on with it. He doesn't have that luxury, and we unfortunately didn't either to use some of those scenarios that the interrogators provided us.
Do you think that dramatic need actually may have influenced the way some viewers thought about torture or its effectiveness?
I certainly hope not. I really do, and I really have to say I give credit to our fans and to anybody who watches the show to effectively distinguish between reality and a television show. And any efforts we could make to disabuse those people who might conflate reality with this television show, I hope we made. And any opportunity to say that, we did. This is, and so did Kiefer, this is a television show. So I think for anybody to confuse that with how things might be done, up to and including the people in the field. I mean, one of the contentions by some people was that we were affecting people in the field. And my response was then, if that's the case, let's disabuse them. Let's become part of their training. And I actually participated in a West Point a training film and a documentary called Primetime Torture with Human Rights First. So I hope that the few people who may have been influenced and took 24 as some kind of primer, which I find really questionable. It's one of those things where I think it's an age-old debate. Does movie violence beget real-life violence? I know there is a correlation, and I hope that I hope it hasn't, is really the short answer to the question.
Well, when you have the torture issue, which changes as news comes in from Guantanamo and everywhere else, the other thing you have with 24 is sometimes you're ahead of the curve. And this goes back to I remember seeing the series pilot before it was on the air, and there was a scene in the pilot in which a terrorist – parachutes out of a passenger airline, leaves a bomb behind, it gets detonated, and this is just a couple of months before 9/11. And what do you remember about the reaction then, both at the network and in your own inner circle? I know that you edited the explosion scene.
Yeah, it was more right. The plane exploded more graphically on camera, and we eliminated that cut entirely, and it played a lot more, indirectly. But I think the conventional wisdom then was, aside from obviously being stunned as everybody else in the world was and everyone in this country, was that this was not a show that would play well in the aftermath of that. Those terrible events, and that in fact, the conventional wisdom was then the networks would respond with comedies and blue sky shows. And it turned out to be quite the opposite, that the show wound up having a unique kind of resonance and relevance because of what had happened. And that caught us all by surprise. But certainly in the immediate aftermath, we thought, wow, we're done. you know, this will never, I mean, maybe they'll air it, but it people won't want to see it.
24 executive producer and writer Howard Gordon. The final 2 hours of 24 are shown tonight on Fox. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From Barnes & Noble, presenting the Nook e-reader, which offers wireless access to the Barnes & Noble e-bookstore, in stores and at nook.com. And from LendingTree, providing customers with the ability to manage their money, credit, and loans all in one place at LendingTree.com. This is NPR.
To celebrate the 85th birthday of composer-conductor Pierre Boulez, some major pieces of music he never commercially recorded are being released. Lloyd Schwartz has a review. Also, we consider the finale of ABC's Lost, and more with Howard Gordon, the executive producer of 24, which has its finale tonight. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, Fresh Air's TV critic, in for Terry Gross. We're talking with Howard Gordon, writer and executive producer of the Fox series 24, which ends its 9-year run tonight with a 2-hour series finale. Before we pick up our conversation, let's listen to a pair of quick clips from the show's second season, featuring some of its most memorable characters. These include Nina Myers, played by Sarah Clark, who had killed Jack Bauer's wife the season before, and President David Palmer, played by Dennis Haysbert, whose assassination attempt Jack had foiled. In Season 2, the new threat was a nuclear device hidden somewhere in Los Angeles. And Nina Myers, who knows where it's hidden, has Jack Bauer at gunpoint as she calls the White House to broker a very unusual deal.
Miss Myers, this is Mike Novick. I'm the President's Chief of Staff.
I asked to speak speak with the president.
He's not available.
Do you want to stop this nuclear bomb or not?
Of course we do.
Then put the president on.
I'm authorized to negotiate on his behalf.
What I want is non-negotiable.
What do you want?
I'll tell you where the bomb is in exchange for immunity.
The president's already granted you a total pardon.
Except this is a crime I haven't committed yet.
What crime?
The murder of Jack Bauer.
After a quick consultation with the team at CTU, President Palmer gets on the phone with Jack Bauer still at gunpoint, but listening on speakerphone.
Myers, this is President Palmer.
I'm listening.
Is Jack Bauer there?
Yes, Mr. President, I'm here too.
Ms. Myers, if the information you provide culminates in the successful interception of the nuclear device, you will get everything you asked for. You will be pardoned in advance for the murder of Jack Bauer.
I can live with that.
Start talking, Nina.
I asked Howard Gordon about the character of President Palmer, who, for a show so rooted in minute-by-minute real time, certainly seemed to be ahead of his time. Another thing that seems very prescient about that initial season was you cast Dennis Haysbert as a black president of the United States, President Palmer. So how influential do you think that was, truly?
Well, truly, I think, you know, the only one who deserves credit for Barack Obama's election is Barack Obama. But what I do think is that what it represented, and this is Joel and Bob, you know, who I was not on the pilot, so I have to, you know, really, you know, I can compliment their great choice in Dennis and in choosing to have a black president rather than just another white guy with silver hair, to me represented what was wonderful and uniquely American about, you know, the sort of best of America that condoned slavery as recently as a century and a quarter ago was able to have a black man at its helm in the chief executive position. That, to me, made him a more valuable target to protect. And do I think it was influential? I think if we're – honestly, I think we deserve as much credit for Barack Obama as we do blame for Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. So that's kind of my I think it certainly didn't – it probably couldn't have hurt to put it out there and to create a character who was so credible and so beloved and, you know, again, having gone in public many places with Dennis Haysbert. I know he's actually been enlisted to run in real life for any number of political offices, and I think he won the seat for Allstate.
This is a couple of seasons later. We have a different president, but it actually links back to President Palmer. And this is a scene when the Secretary of Defense, James Heller, who's played by William Devane, another great actor you pulled in there, claims to have heard a tape that implicates President Charles Logan. Gregory Itzen, you can tell I love his performance, in the assassination of former President Palmer. And he comes to confront Logan about his crimes. And these crimes also involve collusion with petroleum interests in Central Asia and another
labyrinthine, I know.
Yeah, but it's another prescient plot line, you know, about rising oil prices. And it just amazes me to go back a couple of years after these shows were on the air and see what's in them now. So here's President Logan, when he was president, being challenged by the Secretary of Defense, James Heller.
I hope this was important. I know what you did. I know what you're doing. And I'm here to put an end to it. I have to be a little more specific. You are responsible for the murder of David Palmer.
That's outrageous.
I heard a recording. A conversation between you and a man named Christopher Henderson. When Palmer found out about your insane plan, Henderson had him killed, and you let it happen.
Where is this recording?
It's in a safe place.
I would like to hear it.
Why? You know exactly what you said, and so do I. It's burnt into my memory.
How dare you stand there and judge me? You have no idea. Until you sit in my chair, you don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Your chair is not a throne, Charles.
I'm protecting the interests of our country.
You mean oil?
Yes. Yes! This country needs energy more than you or anybody in this gridlock government cares to admit. We'll see how you judge me. When the cost of oil goes up over $100 a barrel and the people who put me in office can't afford to heat their homes or run their cars.
And you think that justifies the blood on your hands?
That's William Devane and Gregory Itzen in a previous season of 24. These things hold up really well on the radio, don't they?
They really do.
The structure of 24, it didn't really have to revolve around the White House, certainly not to the extent that it does season after season. But you've clearly made that choice and you're interested in power at that level. Why?
You know, it's one of the tropes of the thriller. I think, for one thing, the real-time aspect required cutaways, so we knew we needed other stories to be happening. And by the third season, when Secretary Heller, actually, this is the first time we didn't start at the White House, we had a Secretary of Defense and his daughter who had was Jack's romantic interest. We were very scrupulously saying, we're done with the presidency, how we really can't do this. And Secretary Heller was the proxy, or was as high as we went for a time before we went back to President Palmer, mm-hmm. came in to help President Logan, if you'll recall. That's where we relaunched that character. So it became very, very challenging, and we were concerned about it, frankly. But every time we would try, and again, I tell you, we gave it a really strong try. We looked at city government. We looked at purely staying away from it. But the stakes always morphed into these, because of the nature of the threats and the real-time threats, we just found ourselves going there. And that included this year. President Taylor really was going to be a supporting part. We try to keep it unique to the UN, and mm-hmm. and then you'll find there's a reason why in most every thriller, whether it's Tom Clancy or Vince Flynn, you'll find the president is involved. The trick is actually keeping it fresh and trying to find new stories and territory that you haven't mined before. But it's like Shakespeare did, you know, lots of kings and princes for this similar reasons, because the stakes are so large.
Can you talk about the elastic logistics as you're writing this? I mean, if I understand it, most seasons are sort of written in thirds, and you take a big breath, and then
the elastic is right. I would call it more of an improvisation. Again, the nature of the show is that we shot 24 episodes a year, unlike, say, Sopranos or some of the other cable shows that are lucky enough to have to do 10 or 12. We have to do 24 of them. So we would finish typically a season at the end of May, and we would be in pre-production by the middle of June. And so that it was just it's sort of an impossible task, frankly, especially mm-hmm. for a serialized drama. You cannot possibly map out 24 episodes in any detail. And you needed to keep it, as you say, elastic, because sometimes a story, we would think here's an idea and that'll be maybe somewhere mid-season, and it turned out to be episode two. So it was this really kind of mosaic accretion of stories that, you know, we would tell as a group. And that, I think, is what gave it some of its energy, the not knowing where we were going with the show, painting ourselves into corners and demanding ingenious and sometimes absurd, admittedly, solutions to those difficult problems, like amnesia or a cougar in the woods. But sometimes it was just what you had to do to keep 1 hour from bumping into the next. But we did have a motto very early on that Joel and Bob coined, which was not good, never boring, and that we tried to live and die by that particular motto.
Well, I always wondered why you didn't go to a commercial break just at one point. You had so many years to do this, where Jack Bauer, on the way to somewhere, you know, some sense of urgency again, would just say, okay, just a second, and go into the bathroom. And the camera would stay behind outside the door. You just have a few seconds where nothing happened, and then you would hear ka-chink, ka-chink, and go to commercial. I mean,
that film exists. It does exist. We did shoot it. We did try it.
Really?
Yeah. Because it was a question that was asked so often, why doesn't Jack eat and why doesn't he pee? I said, and I always said he does. He just does it while you're not looking, or while we're off on some presidential storyline, or during the commercial, like the rest of us. I don't know. I'd love to unearth it somewhere. I'm sure someone has it somewhere.
Howard Gordon, thanks very much for being on Fresh Air.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Howard Gordon, writer and executive producer of the Fox series 24. Tonight, the show presents its final two episodes of the season and the series. Coming up, I review a series that ended its run last night, ABC's Lost. This is Fresh Air. And now, we shift focus to another long-running series with a much-discussed, much-publicized finale, ABC's Lost. But that show's finale was last night, so we can discuss it in the past tense. The smartest thing the producers of ABC's Lost did, other than generating such an interesting show and series pilot in the first place, was to decide a few years ago to end the series in May 2010. That simple yet bold decision allowed the writers to pace, to focus on what was important, to make the most meaningful use of the time they had left. On the one hand, all that did was turn Lost from an ambitious weekly TV series into an even more ambitious mega TV miniseries. On the other hand, it also turned the TV series into a metaphor for its central message and for the journey of its Lost protagonist. For the show's writers, for us viewers, and for Jack Shepard, the lesson was the same. It's a temporary journey. So enjoy the ride and embrace each other. Instead of giving us one ending, writer-producers Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse gave us two, one for each alternate storyline. This is where, if you weren't following the show, or even if you were, you could easily get lost with Lost. But basically, this past season had us watching two stories at once. On one, our heroes were on the island fighting to return home, and also fighting the island's evil force, who had taken the shape of one of their own. And in the other storyline, seemingly triggered by a nuclear event on the island, the ill-fated Oceanic passenger jet had never crashed on the island, and we saw what the passengers' lives would have been like without the crash, or the island. Except that their lives were different somehow, and so were the details. Enough of that. You either buy into it or you don't. In the expanded 2.5-hour finale, all the people in that alternate existence eventually found one another, giving viewers the satisfaction of one mini-reunion after another. Off the island, without the island, these people touched each other, often literally, and their memories of the island came flooding back to them. So did a feeling of peace. The last person it happened to was Jack, who got that rush of memory when he touched his father's coffin, the coffin he had transported back from Australia. Jack, played by Matthew Fox, opened the lid, and the coffin was empty. But suddenly, next to him, stood his father, played by John Terry, and the biggest question posed by Lost was answered.
I don't understand. You died.
Yeah. Yes, I did.
Then how are you here right now?
How are you here?
I died too.
And then we got the two endings, played out simultaneously. One ending, the one back on the island where Jack had restored the life force to the island but was losing his own, was purely visual. It echoed, in reverse, the powerful opening of the series, returning Jack to the bamboo field where he had first regained consciousness after the plane crash. Lost, the series had begun with a close-up shot of Jack's eyeball, opening. Its final image last night was of that same eye, closing, as Jack died, having accomplished his mission and found his purpose. But the other ending of Lost was purely verbal, returning to one of the show's most resonant and recurrent themes, father-son issues. When Jack's dead dad emerged from that coffin, he explained that it wasn't an alternate timeline at all, but a timeless line, a limbo, a gathering place. And Jack's death in the real world, on the island, enabled the eventual happy reunion of everyone off the island. Yes, it was a little Twilight Zone-y. And as series finales go, the ending of Lost was not as outrageous as Saint Elsewhere, as defiantly open-ended as The Sopranos, as aggressively complete as 6 Feet Under, or as utterly perfect as Newhart. But its two endings together were very satisfying. And the final advice from Jack's dad to Jack should be remembered in the context of watching television, too.
The most important part of your life was the time that you spent with these people. That's why all of you are here. Nobody does it alone, Jack. You needed all of them, and they needed you.
For what?
To remember. And to let go.
Exactly. Remember Lost because its type is not returning to TV anytime soon, if at all. But also, as the father figure says, let go. Don't nitpick over the missing details, the forgotten waltz, the unexplained polar bears. Just say so long, and thanks for all the fish. Or maybe, just thanks. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews some CD and DVD packages, noting the 85th birthday of composer and conductor Pierre Boulez. This is Fresh Air. Composer and conductor Pierre Boulez has been a hero of the avant-garde for more than half a century. To celebrate his 85th birthday this year, a number of new CDs and DVDs have been released that include at least one major piece of music Boulez has never recorded commercially. These releases make our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, very happy.
That's the chilling opening of Symphony in Three Movements, a piece Stravinsky composed for the New York Philharmonic during World War II, which he referred to as his War Symphony. Its pounding, biting rhythms echo his notorious pre-World War I ballet, The Rite of Spring. The most celebrated conductor of Stravinsky's music after Stravinsky himself, some people would say even ahead of Stravinsky, is Pierre Boulez, whose latest Stravinsky recording, one of his best, is a live performance with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, released on CSO Resound, the orchestra's own label. The CD also includes Stravinsky's complete Pulcinella, not just the abbreviated suite, which leaves out the charming, sexy songs. Stravinsky composed this scintillating Commedia dell'arte ballet for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. Stravinsky himself regarded Pulcinella as his first neoclassical work, both his discovery of the past and his transformation of it. He boldly stole themes he thought were all by the 18th century Italian composer Pergolesi, though it turned out some of them were actually by a number of other minor composers. But even though the tunes themselves aren't by Stravinsky, his syncopated rhythms and dazzling, even hilarious combinations of instruments make Pulcinella one of his most original, most modern, most Stravinskian scores, and in the hands of Boulez and the Chicago Symphony, one of his most sparkling. On a new DVD, Inheriting the Future of Music, you can watch Boulez working on Stravinsky's Rite of Spring with young conductors and players at the Lucerne Festival Academy in Switzerland. They adore him because he doesn't condescend to them, and not a note escapes his attention.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. What do you want here also? I stop now, because that's not difficult to... what you want? That's a sforzato piano of the first violin. You have a small accent. Ta. And then you have to show it, because that's 1, 2, 3, 1. Ta.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah. I want to just indicate...
Every detail is at its importance, because suddenly, you have pa, 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 and so on. They are repeating, and then suddenly, suspended. Ta. And nobody moves, only the woodwind.
I was just suspended, but not the accent.
Well, suspend what you want, but I want this accent
yeah.
And then the chord. Okay?
I wish every conductor would take Boulez's advice about finding gestures that convey musical information without being either excessive or too recessive. The new Boulez recording I'm most excited about is a live performance from 1996 of music he isn't generally associated with. And if you didn't know it was Boulez, you might guess some conductor born in Vienna. It's Haydn's Last Symphony, number 104, called the London because that's where it was commissioned and written. And the orchestra is the Vienna Philharmonic. Boulez is famous for his amazing ear. He lets you hear every detail. But there are two other Boulez qualities he isn't often given credit for. One is his innate and effortless sense of the right style. This symphony, for a change, actually sounds Viennese. The other is size. Too many Haydn performances seem small scale, miniature, and tinkly. But Boulez really conveys the grandeur as well as the delicacy of Haydn's magnificent conception.
Thank you.
At 85, and not for the first time, Boulez has announced that he would be cutting back on conducting to devote more time to composing. Of course, we want to hear more of his own music, but since he's the most insightful and incisive conductor now alive, how can our reaction to this decision not be bittersweet?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston, where he is this year's recipient of the Chancellor's Award for Distinguished Scholarship. Congratulations, Lloyd. He reviewed CDs and DVDs featuring Pierre Boulez, released in celebration of his 85th birthday. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, who builds all their vehicles in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count special report addresses the importance of reading by the end of third grade at aecf.org. And from Doubleday Religion, publisher of Toward a True Kinship of Faiths, How the World's Religions Can Come Together, by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, John Powers is just back from the Cannes Film Festival. We'll talk with him about the winners and why this year's festival felt less like an extension of Hollywood than in years past. Join us.